to have as the lead-off speaker for today's session Bob Cohn from the Quran Institute, who will talk to us about the mathematics of coarsening.
Thank you. Okay, so that's a little bit of a misleading title, so I apologize if you were misled. Looking at my title, you might think I was going to tell you all about all kinds of coarsening, and that's a little bit like some speaker trying to tell you all about all kinds of pattern formation. Can't be done. It's not a single coherent subject. I'm actually the more focused title that I sometimes give is Upper Bounds on Coarsening Rates. It's the theme that I began with Felix Otto a couple years ago. The latest work is some work that I did with Xiaodong Yan, just published in Communications, Pure and Applied Math. But I think the whole perspective is new to the majority of people in this audience, so you can't really talk about the latest work efficiently when the foundation isn't present. I'm actually going to concentrate primarily on the earlier work, and apologies to those people who might have heard it already. So, what are we talking about? You see a sort of a typical kind of picture over on the other transparency, and I think people sort of like to be able to think, ponder that picture, so I'll leave that there for a while. But we'll do it this way. My major focus is okay, so in this meeting, there's lots of different kinds of pattern formation under discussion. And a subfield of pattern formation that will get a lot of attention today, didn't get quite so much yesterday, is what I would call energy-driven pattern formation. And within that subfield, there's still a distinction between energy-driven equilibrium pattern formation, patterns that form because they are preferred energetically, and energy-driven transient pattern formation, patterns that form because the equilibrium is very simple, but patterns are used along the way to get there. And that's my topic, is energy-driven transient pattern formation. And it's a subject you all know something about, even if you don't know you know it. Who was it who said we were all talking prose all our life? Was that Lewis Carroll? Most people here, I think, have thought about motion by mean curvature. That's the motion. Oh, everything I want to say works in higher dimensions as well as in two dimensions, but two dimensions is already interesting, already has all the essential ideas. So let's think two-dimensionally. So motion by curvature is then the motion of an interface with normal velocity equal to its curvature. Higher dimensions mean curvature. There's a law that's very important in many material science problems, which goes by the name motion by surface diffusion. Never mind why it's called that. Mathematically speaking, that's very simple. It's the normal velocity of the surface is the tangent Laplacian of the mean curvature. So in the plane, it's two arc length derivatives of the curvature. Motion by curvature is second order. Motion by surface diffusion is fourth order. There's an intermediate law called the Mullins-Sikirka law, which is third order non-local. So in a very formal sense, I would write it as the velocity is the square root of the Laplacian acting on the curvature. And I'll be a little more explicit about that later. And forgive me, I'm actually going to torture you by concentrating on that law for reasons that will become clear pretty soon. So these laws, here are pictures of the kinds of evolutions we're actually talking about. You start with random initial data. I'm interested in a problem that's not really finite size dominated or dominated by boundary effects. I like to think in terms of solutions in all space, but in order to do simulations, you have to do something other than that. So the typical thing is periodic boundary conditions. And also, in order to do analysis, you need some method of talking about averages. So for that, two periodic boundary conditions are very convenient. Picture up at the top is some random initial data. It's already matured quite a bit by the time you get to the first picture, and then later times you can see that the pattern stays relatively invariant, at least to the eye, though the details are certainly not invariant. Under motion, the Mullins-Sekirka law here, you have patterns that are in detail different. If I showed you these pictures, I think you would be able to quickly learn to recognize which one is which. But still, it coarsens in the sense that the length scale increases, while in some very qualitative sense, the rest of the pattern characteristics stay roughly the same. Now, motion by curvature is second order. Motion by Mullins-Sekirka is third order. Motion by surface diffusion is fourth order. If you believe that the system coarsens to develop some suitably defined length scale that's a function of time, and if you believe that there is a well-defined length scale that's a function of time, dimensional analysis permits only one law, and that's a law that relates the length scale to, well, t to the 1/2 for motion by curvature, t to the 1/4 for surface diffusion, t to the 1/3 for Mullins-Sekirka. Okay. Yes, Harvey? Sorry, yes. Surface in this case is a curve. Okay, so where am I going to take this discussion in this talk? So let's spend a few minutes talking a little bit about these evolutions just to make sure we're all on the same page. And then the real development that Felix and I came up with a couple years ago is to say, hey, we should ask a familiar question in a slightly different way. And, in a way, our goal is to be able to prove something. So let's not keep secrets. My major goal is to ask the question of, is there something I can prove about this? And the answer is, well, this characteristic that the patterns are pretty much the same up to scaling at every time, no idea how to prove that. Nor does anyone else. But the idea that there's a well-defined time scale, well, we can go beyond dimensional analysis. We can actually prove something about that. Okay, so that's the plan. Okay, quick reminder about some of these evolutions. So, okay, the basic fact about curvature is that it's the first variation of perimeter. That is to say, for a moving curve, changing curve, evolving curve, the rate of change of perimeter is the integral over the curve of curvature times normal velocity. And you play with that just a moment, and you quickly discover that motion by curvature is to the heat equation as perimeter is to the Dirichlet integral. So if you wish, one way of seeing that is that the rate of change of perimeter is minus the velocity squared. Motion by surface diffusion is also dissipative. It also dissipates perimeter. You go through the same calculation, and the rate of change perimeter is the integral of curvature times the velocity, so you get something negative. Since Laplacian of curvature is a perfect derivative around the curve, the rate of change of volume is zero. And as for the rate of change of perimeter, a better way to write that is to try to write it not in terms of the curvature, but in terms of the velocity. Just invert the Laplacian in that equation there, and then we can rewrite the derivative of the perimeter is, of course, negative. And here we wind up with the gradient Laplacian inverse velocity squared. So that's just another norm. It's not the L2 norm of the velocity, but a non-local negative Sobolev norm. And so that means this is just, you take the same energy, you can study steepest descents in different metrics. And this equation is simply steepest descent for perimeter in a different metric. Mullen-Sikirka is steepest descent in still another metric. So let's be honest about what this law is. Formally, I told you I'd like to think of it as being the velocity being a first-order non-local differential operator acting on pseudo-differential operator acting on curvature. But what I really mean is you should take your curve to find the normal velocity, solve Laplace's equation outside and inside with the curvature as Dirichlet data. So, of course, usually you'll get a different Neumann data outside versus inside. So take the jump across the curve of the Neumann data, and that's the normal velocity. You could write that as this auxiliary function we defined. Its Laplacian is 0 outside the curve, inside the curve. The normal derivative jumps, so that's the distributional Laplacian is really the normal derivative, is really this jump in the normal derivative, that's the velocity, distributed along the curve as a delta function. So you can go through the same calculation. Let's not make you work. It's too early in the morning for that. You go through the same calculation. Volume is again preserved. Perimeter again decreases. And everything comes out exactly the same, except the norm that shows up here is the norm that has the full space Laplacian inverse instead of the Laplacian along the curve inverse showing up. So different negative norm. Okay, so that's quick review of geometric evolutions, and these are very simple geometric evolutions. So Nick suggested that this morning would be about patterns in material science. You'll hear from John Wilkening about much more sophisticated geometrical evolutions that are true sort of material science problems. This one is a sort of a model problem, a schematic problem, but it's not completely without connection to material science. In fact, Mullen-Sikirka, sometimes in the disguise of Ostwald ripening, and sometimes specifically in this Mullen-Sikirka form, is a widely studied and more or less experimentally verified model of phase separation in the setting of spinodal decomposition. That's the decomposition that would come by quenching a binary alloy, something that undergoes a second-order phase transformation. So only I'm getting ahead of myself, so let me slow myself down. So the questions here, the questions I'm trying to ask is, first, if you're a stickler for detail, you might be worried about whether my geometric evolutions are well-defined, because these geometric evolutions definitely have pinch-off, even in the plane. So my laws were sort of assuming smooth solutions. You might worry about whether we know what we're doing at pinch-off. But more than that, you might worry about, well, why we should care. And the answer I would like to offer to both is that we can work with a Kahn-Hilliard equation that's essentially, for my purposes, a diffuse interface model or a phase field-like model of interface motion. And the physics is really in Kahn-Hilliard. Kahn-Hilliard can be derived rigorously as a mean field model of various sort of statistical physics picture of what might be happening in a sort of simple phase transformation setting. Or you can just write it down as a Landau theory for phase separation. Let me quickly try to tell you a little bit. I think many people here have thought about Kahn-Hilliard equations, so we'll go quickly over that. But Okay, so what do I mean by a Kahn-Hilliard equation? Well, let's consider an energy that has an order parameter m, scalar value. It has a bulk term which captures the thermodynamics, and a gradient term which finally is going to give us surface energy. At high temperatures, W, the potential, prefers just one value, but suppose at lower temperatures there's a bifurcation and it prefers two values. Then when you take the system in its high temperature preferred state, lower the temperature, that state goes unstable, and it would evolve by, well, some equation that's going to decrease this energy. If you're doing phase separation, that equation should certainly be conservative, and let's not try to do the modeling now, but for many systems, the common belief is that it should be the fourth order equation. So MT is the divergence of a current, and the current itself is the negative gradient of the first variation. First variation of the energy is already a second order operator, so that gives us a fourth order operator. And okay, and you go, so you can go through the same calculation that we went through a moment ago for our motion laws. Here's the calculation as you saw it for Mullins-Sekirka. That was Mullins-Sekirka. And what I want to point out to you, is that when you go through that calculation, in one case I'm calculating the rate of energy decrease for this energy, in the other case it's the rate of perimeter decrease. But the end of those two calculations is very similar. I get negative sine, of course, the integral, the gradient, Laplacian inverse. The only difference is that in one case, you get the velocity distributed along the curve as a delta function. In the other case, you get the time derivative of the order parameter, which, of course, is only changing along the boundary, along the interface. So up to the question of whether the interface is sharp or diffuse, these are really the same. And is the interface sharp or diffuse? Well, if I'm doing steepest descent for this energy, then there's no small parameter. So the interface will be, I'm solving a nice big domain. So, and, you know, I'm a bad artist. One of the reasons I like to do these hand-drawn pictures is that they allow me to criticize them. This picture is supposed to be a hand-drawn schematic of that picture. It doesn't look very much like it, of course. But what's the difference is that in this picture, the interface is sharp, but that's just because the true calculation had to be scaled way down in order to see anything. The true calculation, the interface was diffuse of order one, but I would have had to fill like a couple of walls in order to show you the whole picture. So, and that's what's really happening. So if I don't rescale space, then I've got interfaces whose width is of order one, but then I've got domains that are huge. Larger and larger if you believe that the system is coarsening. So if you rescale so that the length scale that's really visible to you is the length scale of the domains, that's what's been done in plotting these pictures, then of course the interfaces become essentially sharp. Okay, so what's the bottom line? The bottom line is that if you believe that coarsening is going to take place, then in the coarsening regime, when the length scales of the domains has gotten nice and large, then studying the Kahn-Hilliard dynamics associated with this equation and studying my Mullins-Sekirka law are really the same. There's, if I were to use second-order steepest descent dynamics, just the Allen-Kahn or heat equation associated with this energy, I would similarly get motion by curvature. And there is also a way of defining a Kahn-Hilliard-like equation that gets surface diffusion. For that, you need a degenerate mobility. But so let me not clutter the discussion with that. Okay, that was the introductory stuff. And so now you're all experts in geometric evolutions, and the question is, what do I want to do? So these geometric evolutions we're talking about, they're all steepest descents, and I'm going to concentrate on Mullins-Zucurca via Kahn-Hilliard, but everything I say can also be done for motion by surface diffusion by way of its Kahn-Hilliard-like model. And the real issue is this coarsening behavior. And if I bore you up to now because you know a lot, or if I lost you because somehow I'm talking too fast, either way you can wake up because more or less at this point we're starting fresh with the real business of the day. So Kahn-Hilliard equation here I chose a particular quartic double well potential, but don't fuss over the algebra because I won't use the algebraic. My discussion is entirely depends upon the sort of equation being related to a suitable energy. It doesn't really depend upon the polynomial structure. And we're interested in solutions that are started with random initial data. It's equally likely to be positive or negative, and that's why you get these equal volume fraction patterns. Periodic, just in order to be able to solve a problem. We're interested in large period cells because we don't want to be dominated by edge effects or finite size effects. And the observation is that as time gets large, the length scales like for Kahn-Hilliard, scales like t to the 1/3, and, well, also that the patterns are statistically self-similar in some suitable sense. So here's what I want to do. I want to try to, I'd like to prove that the length scale grows like t to the 1/3, but I can only prove an inequality. And that's actually at the heart of what I want to tell you. And I'm going to do it by a method that's extremely simple, that's not really more difficult than what you do when you use energy estimates and Grönwald's inequality to prove maybe that the initial value problem of Navier-Stokes has a well-defined solution, at least for a while. And so the method is so simple that you would think it's magic, it's the best thing since sliced bread. So you go around looking for other things you can do with the same method, and, well, we found a few. Okay. So here's the real heart of the matter. First, you've got to walk before you can run, or maybe I should say crawl before you can walk. So we're not going to try to prove this kind of self-similarity as a conjecture. I have nothing really new to say about that picture. The numerics makes it seem pretty definitely the case, and no one knows why. What I would like to focus on is instead that assertion that it coarsens at a well-defined rate. So that's really two assertions. First assertion is that it doesn't coarsen faster, and the other one is that it doesn't coarsen slower. The statement that it doesn't coarsen slower, that's the statement that it doesn't get stuck, that's false. Well, there are configurations that are critical points for the energy. They're maybe unstable. Maybe you won't hit them easily with typical initial data, but they're out there. So if you want to prove it doesn't get stuck, you must either somehow prove that generic initial data won't get to where they get stuck, or introduce some notion of it won't get stuck with probability 1. Maybe you need some noise in the equation. It's quite possible that that's only true if you put some noise in the equation. So that requires either a probabilistic framework or sort of a global sense of where things are going under this evolution. So that's quite difficult, and I don't know how to do that, so I'm not going to try. But the other half of the statement that it can't course in too fast. It can't just say, hey, I want to be simple. I'm out of here. And it can't do that. It's got a sort of protocol. There are rules. And the protocol doesn't permit it to course in too fast. So that's, and this I think is our main insight, that that's actually something that should be true universally, so it should be accessible by PDE methods without any need for exceptions, without any need for a statistical framework. Okay, so good plan. How are we going to achieve it? Now, this projector is okay for reminding you, but it's not okay for first approach. So the plan is very simple. We're going to introduce two ways of thinking about the local length scale. So my picture has had very clear length scale to the eye, but how do you say that mathematically? So we'll introduce one that's a sort of, I like to call it a physical length scale. It'll be a negative norm of the order parameter. Of course, the energy is essentially perimeter. Energy per unit area is, perimeter is like length, area is like length squared, so energy per unit area is 1 over length. So, and then we'll use two facts. One is that they're related by a fact of functional analysis, and the other is that they're related by an energy inequality, and that'll turn out to be all we really need. Okay. So what's the idea with this physical length scale? I mean, the energy per unit area, my transparency says per unit volume, but in 2D, volume is area. That one's pretty clear. Now, I guess I'm fuzzing a little bit. In this problem, I always think sharp interface, even though I do the analysis with Kahn-Hilliard diffuse interface. But if you'd prefer to do the analysis sharp interface, it can be done that way, no problem. Physical length scale. So how do we define a length scale associated with pictures like this? Well, no problem, right? You sort of take your ruler and you measure the average width or something like that. Well, we need something that we can relate to the equation, so we need something a little more systematic. In one dimension, the natural choice would be quite clear. Take a function that's approximately plus or minus 1 with mean value 0. Integrate it once. Its first integral is going to be a sort of sawtooth function. And the typical length scale would be any reasonable norm, L1, L2, something like that, of the sawtooth function. Right? Because the length scale is, in one dimension, the distance between these kinks. And that's essentially the same as the magnitude of the excursions of the sawtooth, which has slope plus or minus 1. And by the way, my fact of functional analysis that I'm going to rely on in this case, it's very simple. It says that the average excursion of the sawtooth measured, say, in L1, and the number of teeth, so that's up here, that's the number of interfaces per unit length, they're related by having their product be greater than or equal to an absolute constant. Okay, and it's not maybe familiar, but it's easy enough to prove. Okay, in higher dimensions, well, yeah, that put the recent one. This is actually, would you like that one? Is that good? Okay. So how? Well, that's especially good pairing, isn't it? Because then we have one dimension. So how are we going to do something like that in higher dimensions? So we need some way of thinking about integrating once and then taking a norm. And so if you ever thought about that, that's not too difficult, right? If you think in Fourier space, well, differentiation is multiplying by the wave vector and integration is dividing by the wave vector, and so you can do that. And, well, that definition, if I were to formulate it in real space in a sort of an L2-based norm, you would get something like this. This is the norm which in Fourier space I would get by dividing by k at frequency k and then summing the squares, right? And so it's one integration. And in real space, I could also say, well, that's just dual to the standard H1 norm. So I could write it that way. And then I could stop and think a minute and say, hey, but wait a second. We're studying an energy that's sort of like perimeter. Perimeter is sort of like the bounded variation norm, that is to say the L1 norm of the gradient. So it might be convenient to use L1 and L infinity, so to speak, duality instead of L2 duality. So from that viewpoint, it's maybe a little more natural to use a norm that's similar to this one, but using test functions that are Lipschitz continuous. So that's like L. And so that's dual to W1 infinity, which makes it formally like an L1 type norm. Dual to L infinity should be L1. So I like to write that as the L1 norm of grad inverse M, but don't get carried away. I don't really mean that I've integrated once and then taken the L1 norm of anything. I mean this duality definition. But actually, don't concentrate too hard. The only important thing is that I'm going to introduce a length scale that's given by some kind of negative Sobolev norm. Okay. So, so I gave you the rough plan before, and here's the detailed plan. I've now explained that L is a sort of negative Sobolev norm. E is the original energy, but if you think sharp interface, it's just perimeter. And so my claim is that, well, the energy decreases, no surprise there. Second is that there's an energy relation that relates the rate of change of that negative Sobolev norm to the rate of change of the energy. And the third is that there's a pointwise inequality, something that has only to do with functional analysis, not with our evolution, that says that my negative Sobolev norm measuring length scale times my energy that measures length scale in a different way, their product is greater than or equal to a constant. So the first relation, we've all dealt with energy relations. You have an equation, you multiply by something, you integrate by parts. If it's true, the proof is trivial, right? Okay, it's true and the proof is, well, I could do it on one transparency, it's pretty trivial, so you'll just believe it, right? Okay. Facts of functional analysis. Well, you know, so there's a lot of them, we use them all the time. Sobolev inequalities. Isoperimetric inequality is a sort of a fact of functional analysis. The relationship between perimeter and volume can be formulated as a relationship between bounded variation norm and some LP norms. This one is similarly a fact of functional analysis. If I restrict myself to the sharp interface setting, it's roughly the statement that the L1 norm is an interpolant between the bounded variation norm and my negative Sobolev norm. So, again, trivial or not, it's just a fact of functional analysis. We should be able to look it up. Actually, this one isn't so easy to look up, but it's not so hard to prove. So, you'll believe me on that, too. So, then there's nothing to do. Well, that, of course, what usually when we prove things using energy relations for PDEs, the remaining thing to do is some Grönwall inequality type thing. So the thing that lies in this region as well, you know. So if that's all the information we're going to harvest from our problem, does it actually tell us something about the coarsening rate? And the answer is that it tells us about the coarsening rate in some time average sense. So don't read that too carefully. It's too complicated. So let's spend a moment. In fact, let's spend a moment talking about why it's so complicated. Okay. So where are we? So imagine one had a very good idea that we should try to separate this coarsening question into two halves and prove only one half, an upper bound. Then we had the good idea to introduce two length scales, and we realized we had a bunch of information. And the question is that information sufficient to draw the conclusion we were hoping for? You can sort of see what's going on, because if in my energy relation I said I had equals instead of inequality, and if in this, let's call it isoperimetric relation, I had equals instead of inequality, well, then I would have, then E would be 1 over L, and I would have an ODE that I could integrate up, and you integrate that up exactly, it's down here, and you would get that the energy is like a constant times time plus another constant to the minus 1/3. C0 comes from the equation, but C1 comes from the initial data. You have to go far enough into the future, and then it scales in the expected way. And, of course, similar relation for L. And so we can see that the whole point here is to figure out whether we can get an inequality here if you break these, if you only have inequalities here and here. Well, it sounds plausible, right? So at that point, of course, you go home, you have a beer, you decide you're almost finished, there's really only a matter of cleaning up, so do that tomorrow. And then you wake up in the middle of the night, and you say, oh, if that were true, it would be true, you know, I'm trying to just use ODE information, so I can't use the PDE anymore. So then if I could plug in any power loss, T to a power for L and E, and if they're permitted by my relations, then that restricts a little bit the powers. So we can tell by that simple test what possible growth rates are consistent with the ODE information that we found. And unfortunately, by this test, you see that you cannot, that L and E have very asymmetric roles. You cannot, by this method, eliminate the possibility of T to the 1/2 growth in L. I'm not interested in proving things that don't scale the way I expected, so that's too bad, but it still leaves the possibility that the energy per unit area that you might be able to, so this suggests that its power law might still satisfy the expected similarity law. So it says that by this method I cannot expect to prove that L is like T to the 1/3, but maybe I could prove that E is like T to the minus 1/3. Okay, so you think a little more, and you discover that by another similarly simplistic test, that's not true either. That E is not greater than or equal to T to the minus 1/3, even for sufficiently large times. And the test is okay, so it still fits on one transparency, and the test for this is a suitable linear functions of, you know, let E be a linear function of time, let L be a linear function of time, so then in the EL plane, as time goes, it's going up here, and then just, okay, so never mind the details of the test, it failed. Then you begin to worry. Is this idea hopeless? Is it even true? Well, let's see. We gave up trying to prove that L is like T to the 1/3. We're trying to prove that E is like T to the minus 1/3. The energy is a Lyapunov function. It's decreasing. So its graph it never increases. Its graph is sort of like the Brown line. We're trying to estimate it like polynomial decay. Is it even true? Well, you can sort of see that, why did I draw these kinks? Well, at moments of pinch-off, you have a lot of curvature. The energy should be decreasing quickly. So So you get some big event. So is it true? I don't know. But then, okay, so that's why we got this complicated picture, which, so then we worked a little more and we said, okay, but maybe it's true in a time average sense, and that turns out to be the case. So the time averaged over a sufficiently long period of time, time averages of the energy per unit area satisfy an inequality that's identical to what you would have gotten trivially by time averaging E greater than or equal to T to the minus 1/3. Okay, and how do you prove that? Well, once you think it's true, you just mess. It's just ODEs, right? Once you think it's true, it can't be too complicated. Okay, now I should wrap up in about 5 minutes. Is that right? Yeah. Okay. So that's the outline of where things are. And so what did I do? I told you the overall framework, the viewpoint, and I told you in some detail how it works for Kahn-Hilliard, which I view as a diffuse interface model of Mullins-Tokerka. And the overall framework is easy, right? You have to define the physical length scale, then use a little energy inequality, a little functional analysis, and some kind of ODE lemma. And well, it doesn't give everything we hoped for, but it gives a little something at least. And says nothing about statistical self-similarity. And as I said, after you've done this, then and suddenly you think you've invented a very powerful tool, and so you go out looking, trying to do something with it. And well, motion by surface diffusion works very much the same, using a degenerate mobility Kahn-Hilliard equation. If your order parameter has a finite number of preferred values and a vector valued energy instead of just scalar valued order parameter and plus or minus one, then you can do something very similar. Xiaodong Yan and I worked on an epitaxial growth model. I'll tell you in a moment about that. Motion by curvature, it seems not possible, at least I don't know how to do it, to study motion by curvature from this viewpoint. There's a model widely called, sometimes known as grain growth, in which the plane is separated into regions, each one different from the next. Angle conditions at triple junction and curvature motion away from triple junctions, that's a natural candidate, don't know. A lot of people have studied the motion of vortices. Well, the question here isn't what's the ODE for vortices. The question here is take a lot of vortices and some plus signs, some minus signs, let them loose in the plane. They'll find one another and annihilate. And after a while, there'll be fewer vortices. How many are there as a function of time? So, don't know whether it might be used for that. Quick hint of what Xiaodong and I did on the epitaxial growth model. There's a lot of epitaxial growth models around, and so this is one of many, and does it really describe any epitaxial system? I don't know. But it has an interesting coarsening behavior. It's just the heat equation associated with this functional over here that prefers U as a scalar-valued function in the plane, so this prefers slopes of norm 1, but it prefers not to have the slope jump. It's kind of an energy that's come up in other pattern formation settings, including, say, work on the phase diffusion equation. And if we just take its standard L2 steepest descent, well, what do you expect? This is my very schematic one-dimensional picture, but I'm thinking the problem is really two-dimensional. You expect you're going to have slopes plus and minus 1. The energy, roughly speaking, is associated with peaks and valleys as defects. And coarsening means larger length scale, fewer peaks and valleys. The observed length scale numerically is T to the 1/3. And we can prove such a result using our methods, of course, as always, as a bound. And the hard part, the negative norm is obvious. It's just the L2 norm of U. The energy relation is also more or less the same as it was before. It's easy. The hard part is this fact of functional analysis, the isoperimetric inequality, because the defect energy is no longer perimeter. Okay, so let me wrap up there. This is transient energy-driven coarsening. This is pattern formation on the way to very simple equilibrium. It's full of open problems. There's the idea that structures are statistically self-similar is well established numerically, but completely open analytically. Even the question of why it should be true, or what you mean, is open analytically. So little progress, and that's that we can learn how to prove upper bounds, one-sided bounds on coarsening rates. Well, little tiny hint of progress in an ocean of open problems, like, of course, most of the things we work on here. Okay. Thank you very much.